boy, where do we dive in? I want to say a couple things, and then we'll get to some slides. Boy, this has been not the way I think any of us thought this was going to go, right? And so I want to say off to a great start. Usually when I get up here and give a talk, I've thought about it for months or at least weeks, and this one has been about 3 days. And I feel like every day I've rewritten this message to something else. And so I think I got clear about what to say about an hour ago. So we'll work through it. And this is not feel sorry for Charlie moment, but I want to explain to you kind of what I think this job is. I think it's the job of the pastor, whether it's in preaching or it's in counseling, to stand in the space between what the Spirit is doing inside of me and then paying attention to what's happening inside of you all or in counseling the person, and then to figure out in that space, what do you say and what do you not say? And what's the right time to say something and how forcefully do you say it? And the best analogy I have is as parents, like with your kids, you don't tell them everything they need to learn immediately, right? Like at first, it's just like, can we get over the soiling of one's pants? And you work at that. And then you work eventually at like, how do you be appropriate with girls? But you don't work about being appropriate with girls at 3 years old. You worry about that at like 15, you know? Like, and so you're always trying to figure that out. Like, what is it that this body needs to hear this morning? And what are you hoping to hear? And what do we need to say? And what needs to be said? And so I hope that maybe in this space this morning, there's some hope and some perspective and maybe some challenge. And that's a lot of pressure to put on myself. And so I just want to say I've really appreciated this week that several of you have been very gracious to me and made me feel held. Some of you have called me and texted me and emailed me and just said, wow, your task on Sunday is huge. And I thought, thanks for the pressure. And no, I'm kidding. I felt loved and supported. I know. And so it's been a really, really intense week. So not knowing the way this was going to go, on Tuesday, I did a podcast with my friend Nathan that you all really, really should listen to, because I thought that was going to be the most intense thing of my whole week. And Nathan and his wife, Nathan was a worship leader at Richwoods, and I know many of you used to go there and know Nathan really well. And he and his wife had a baby that was born with trisomy 18, and he talks really openly and honestly about their journey through that. And it was heartbreaking and hopeful and good, and we just had a great time together, but it was intense and good. And I think Jennifer said it was a three crier on her walk when she listened to it, because it's really good and honest. And so you should listen to that. And then Wednesday morning, I woke up and the world had turned upside down. And there's my Hamilton reference. You just started singing that. I love it. It's been really, so then out of that, I think Wednesday and Thursday, pretty much from the time I woke up in the morning to the time I went bed at night, it was just intense conversation after intense conversation after intense phone call, intense email, Facebook, you know, like all the time. And I want to say a special shout out to, on Thursday morning, we had our brunch with the staff time, and that group has become like a great sounding board. So I literally sat down with them on Thursday morning. I was like, tell me what to teach. I don't know. And so that was just really helpful and really good conversations. And then on Thursday, I did another podcast with two pastor friends of mine, Bill Dole from St. Paul's Lutheran and Stephen McKinney Whitaker from United Presbyterian. And we kind of talked about what do you say to your church and how do you navigate through these kinds of times when, I'll talk about this in a minute, but when you have a wide diversity of thought in this room. And so we had a great conversation. We were eating lunch the whole time. So if you listen to the podcast, sorry, there's a little bit of that going on, but the chef and the baker is so, so good. Sorry. Yeah. If you haven't been there, you should. And so all that just to say, we shortened the music to give ourselves some time to work through some things and to talk. Oh, so where I was going with this is, before I say any of this, I just want to say, I hope you're taking care of yourself and doing the things that you need to do to take care of your own mental health wherever you are at. And so for me, part of that is Friday is my day off. The kids were out of school. And so this is the way I kind of deal with things sometimes. Either I find a project to do or I dive into a book. And so what I would like to spend the rest of my morning talking about is free diving, death, and the quest to shatter the human limits. And I'd like to explain to you the intricacies of free diving and how deep people can go and what happens when you do it wrong. I'm kidding. But that's what I've been thinking about for the last 48 hours. It's a really good book that has nothing to do with anything. And I told Jennifer last night, like, it's been really great the last 48 hours that I've almost finished that book in 48 hours. And it's sometimes we need to do what we need to do. And sometimes I just want to say to all of you all, maybe I know some of you on Thursday or Wednesday just went for walks in the woods and got off social media and did the things you have to do to tend to your own souls. And I just want to encourage you that whatever you have to do, even if it's like hard, to do that thing that'll tend to your soul and help you get perspective. So that's the invitation. So things just kept evolving all week long. And so I had a message in mind on last Sunday, and that kind of went out the window a little bit. Those things are all still true. We're just going to move them all to next week because I think that what I was going to say today makes more sense if we do that with Christ the King Sunday, which is next Sunday, and I'll explain all that next week. But then dealing with my own thoughts and feelings and all that, and getting to like what do we need to hear this morning? What do we need to talk about? What do we need to wrestle with? And so what I'm going to give you this morning, I think, is 5 mini sermons. And at the end of each one, we're going to pause, and I'm going to give you an exercise or a moment to breathe and to reflect, and then we're going to move on to the next one. Because I think these are the things I needed to say. And I left some things on the editing room floor and chucked some things out that maybe just weren't necessary or helpful or beneficial. We'll see how it goes. I'm off to a fumbling start, so here we go. If you're new to Imago, one of the things you've got to understand and know about who we are as a church, and for those of you that have been around, you know this, but I'm just going to remind us, is that we've used this terminology before, that we're a big tent church. I used this terminology for the first time, I think it was 2 years ago in January, and we kind of revived it last January a little bit, and then it's kind of sat in different places, and somebody this week brought my attention to it, and I was like, yeah, we need to start there a little bit. So this is what that means, especially if you're new with us, and I just want you to understand the dynamic in this room this morning. I grew up in a solidly Baptist evangelical context, and I could have safely assumed on a morning like this that everybody in my church had voted almost this exact same way I did, right down the whole ticket. Kind of the premise of the evangelical church in America is that we are who we are because we all agree. So when you go to an evangelical church, often the first thing that you're presented with is a statement of beliefs or a set of doctrines, and that we are the church we are, we define who we are, the people that sit in the room or sit in leadership or whatever are the people, those people are in those spots because we agree about these lists of things. And oftentimes, it can be a fairly long list of things that we agree about and all kinds of doctrines and all kinds of issues. And so growing up, I would have assumed that on a Sunday like this, when I walked into the room, most of the people in my church, if not all the people in my church, had voted Republican that election. That was just the way I was raised. I was raised in the era of the moral majority. My parents were very active in the abortion issue. They, when I was a young kid, they actually picketed outside the office up on Knoxville. Nope, university. And then at some point in my life, my parents thought picketing doesn't seem very useful or beneficial. And so my mom gave many of her career years to working at the Women's Pregnancy Center because she felt like that was more productive to offer a solution rather than just tell people why they were wrong, which I really admire. If that's your conviction, live out of that place. That's good. And so, there would have been celebration in the churches I grew up in today. There would have been celebration today that the good side had won, the right side had won. And I'm saying all that to give you a context that especially if you come out of that kind of a background, that's not this church. That's not who's in this room this morning. We don't claim that agreeing on the issues is what binds us together as a church. I said this last week, and I'll say it again because I think it's true. And I'm stealing it from the No Joke Project and Jim Henderson. And he says that the agreement is not a pathway to relationship. It's just not. If agreement is what's required for relationship, I'm screwed. Because I doubt that any of us agree on everything. In fact, I know that my wife and I agree about things. I'm not going to tell you which ones, but we do. There's times and things that come up that, hey, I want to do it this way. Nope, I'd rather do it this way. And if you don't know that about your spouse, wait till you have kids. You will know this. Here's what I think. Here's what I think. We should take away their phone for 3 months. We should take away their phone for 2.5 months. We totally disagree on this. No, I'm kidding. So in this church, what we're trying to say is that we're trying to keep the number of things we agree at as minimal as possible. The centrality of Jesus and following Jesus and love as the central ethic of Jesus, and that we know you're a Christian not because of your creed, but we know that you're a Christian because of the way that you love. What Jesus said about, they'll know that you, when you love like I love, says the man who just washed everyone's feet, including the one who would betray him, then they'll know that you're Christians. That's pretty central to who we are, and a lot of the other stuff, we're willing to just let it slide and sit with our differences. And so I want you to hear that to say that I know, I've talked to you, many of you this week, and I know that in this room are some of you that voted for Donald Trump, some of you that voted for Jill Stein, some of you that voted for Gary Johnson, some that voted for Hillary Clinton, some that didn't vote, some that voted and left that one blank. Almost every iteration of those is sitting in this room right now this morning. So, that feels different, right? It's one thing to maybe be in a safe spot where you know everybody agrees with you and you can just unleash whatever it is on either side. If you know, if you're a Trump supporter and you sit in a room with all Trump supporters, yeah, high five each other, slap each other's back, you won, yay, 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 right? And if you're a room of all people that voted for Clinton and you all feel the same way, you can all, you know, cry together. But what do you do in your church and my brothers and sisters are sitting right next to me and I otherwise love them and I really disagree with everything that they voted for? Like on Facebook, share. What do we do with that? And so as a church, what we've been trying to do, and we've been leaning into this for a long time. So in our seats sit people who believe in literal six-day creation and people are like, that's just crazy talk. We have people that believe different theories of atonement and different things about eschatology and different things about the literalness of the scriptures or not. We have people that have a wide range of opinions about all those things, and we keep working at it. In this past year, we have people that disagree about what we should say to our LGBT brothers and sisters, and we keep working through it, and we keep saying we're going to keep making space for people, even if they don't agree with our practice of inclusion. That's okay. You don't have to agree with it. But we include everybody in our process of sorting these things out. Everybody's included. Every voice is included. I want to hear, like, if you have a thought on a topic today, you're welcome. Bring it. Let's talk about it. Let's put it in the open and discuss it and try to understand each other. That's what we are trying to do as a church. And so that informs how we talk about what happened in the last week. It informs how we post on Facebook, what we share, the conversations that we have, is that we're brothers and sisters who don't always agree, but agreement isn't the basis of our fellowship as a church. Our commitment to Jesus and love is what binds us together. So, what I want to do for just a minute as we launch into four other sermonettes is I want to start by just being quiet for a moment and putting our hands on our lap if you're willing. And in that space, I want you just to hold your hands open as a symbol of just being open to the other. Maybe the other is sitting right next to you. Maybe they're across the room. Maybe you have a different other person in mind that you're in dialogue with. And for just a minute, I want you in your hands to hold the tension of all that. And then I'm going to lead us in a prayer. God, I thank you that agreement isn't a requirement for relationship, or I would have no friends. And I'm thankful for this brave, courageous group of people. It's easy to retreat into our corners where everything is an echo chamber and everybody says yes to everything I say. It's harder to sit in relationship when we just don't understand and we don't agree. And so I just want to acknowledge and say we're thankful for this space, and we're thankful for these people who keep loving me when they disagree with me. And I want to ask for all of us to fill us with graciousness, fill us with kindness, fill us with empathy. Help us to disagree in ways that are loving and kind. And help us to see that our strength is in our diversity. In your name I pray. Amen. So, if we're going to live in this big tent, then I think that one of the things that many of us have felt over the last week, and as we've reflected more, what we've seen over the last week, is that I think what we saw on Tuesday is that a large number of Americans felt neglected and misunderstood and not listened to. And that neglect and not listened to fueled a lot of stuff. And in response to a group feeling neglected and not listened to and getting energized, another group now feels neglected and not listened to. And what I see on Facebook, I think we all agree on this, is a lot of people talking and not a lot of people listening. A lot of people saying stuff. I mean, it's so easy, right? A lot of people saying stuff. I'm like, yes, I agree, I agree, I agree. You're an idiot. And not a lot of, and I've seen precious, great examples out of some people in this church. The two people I'm thinking of specifically, neither one of whom are here this morning, great. So I can use their names freely. I will later. But there's not a lot of this. And I think one of the things I've been challenged, Jennifer and I both this week have had conversations with people who have said things like, just get over it, it's gonna be fine, move on. What? I'm telling you that I have some emotions about this and you're telling me to move on, right? And that doesn't feel very loving in that moment. In fact, you kind of shut down, right? And so one of the things that I think is an important skill in life in the big tent, and it's an essential skill if we're going to love in the way that Jesus loved, is to cultivate empathy in us. Empathy is the ability to sense other people's emotions, coupled with the ability to imagine what someone else might be thinking or feeling. That part of what it means to be loving, I believe, is that we have an ability. I want to say that it's a skill. I want to say that we can learn to do this. Now, we all know that there's some people that are naturals at this, right? You have friends in your life where you just know when things are hard, I'm going to talk to this person, and when I tear up, they will tear up, right? You all know these people? I hope you know these people. That, like, just people that are deeply empathetic. There's some people that just seem to have it in spades. And we also know the people in our lives that when we share our deepest, darkest stuff, it's just blank, right? And they might even tell us later on that I felt it really deep, man. But it didn't register at all, right? It didn't feel like you felt me. And so empathy then is the skill, I think, that can be taught and learned. And it's this ability to imagine what somebody else might be thinking or feeling. I think if we're going to be loving in the world as Christians, if we're going to love as Jesus loved, one of the things that we ought to be doing and we ought to have done in the past week is cultivated and exercised the ability to imagine what somebody else might be thinking or feeling. Whether that someone is a white, middle, lower, middle, uneducated, whatever titles they use in the Midwest, or that somebody is an immigrant or Muslim or whatever. That what it means to be loving. Let me give you this picture. Your kid wakes up screaming because they've had a bad dream and they think there's monsters in the room. What you don't do is walk in and say, you're an idiot for thinking that there's monsters in the room. Get over it. What do? You go in and you hug them, you love them, You let them know that they're held and they're supported and dad's there. And then when they feel that, then you suggest to them that there's not monsters in the room. But you don't lead with facts and you're dumb for feeling the way they feel, because what they feel in that moment is absolutely 100% real to them. And so you connect to them and you let them know that they're loved and they're held and you're safe. And then you can have a conversation about the reality of monsters or not. And some of us want to jump so fast, even on Facebook, to, hey, it's going to be fine, stop overreacting. That doesn't feel loving at all. So this following after Jesus, I think, means that we are in the ongoing process, even those of us that maybe have empathy just in spades, of refining and growing in our ability to be empathetic, to grow in our ability to see the world as somebody else sees, to listen hard so that we can say, this is what this person actually sees. This is why they feel afraid. And so it requires, I think somebody earlier, I said something about listening, like it requires deep listening. I want you to listen, and I'm going to read two Facebook posts to you. And I want you to listen. Empathy doesn't require me to agree. I need to say this before I read. Empathy does not require me to agree. Agreed? That's funny. To me. When my kid says there's a monster in the room, I don't agree. I just don't. Mostly. But I can still be empathetic. I can still see the world that they did, and I can still try to remember that time when I was a kid and I believed that if I just got under the covers, I'd be safe. And if I dangled my hand off the bed, I was toast, right? Like, I do everything I can to listen to them and go back to that place, even though I think they're wrong. So empathy doesn't require me to agree with the person, but simply to try to see the world that they see and to think what they might be thinking or feeling. The first one I want you to listen to, this is a letter. It's from my friend, Rabbi Daniel Bogard. He was one of the rabbis here in town, and he and his wife moved to Cincinnati now. And so we've become friends through the No Joke Project. I trust him. I know him. He's a great guy. I want you to listen to what he's thinking and what he's feeling as an American Jew. To my daughters and to my son, I am so, so sorry. I'm sorry that I burst into sobs and tears when I saw you today. I had dreamed of a world where you would, from the very earliest moments of your life, know that you live in a place where presidents can look like you, and the heartache was overwhelming. I'm so terribly sorry that this is the world that we have left for you. I had thought that we had grown as a nation to the point where if a man objectified, sexualized, and made claims on women's bodies, that the vast majority of us would say, at the very least, that this disqualified him from the highest offices. I was wrong. But I promise that I will work with everything I have to change that. I will work to change it within myself, the ways that I blindly go about with male privilege every day, within our schools, where we know that around a third of college women have experienced sexual assault. If you don't have empathy with that statement alone, a third of college women have experienced sexual assault. Within our Jewish community, where we know that abuse exists at the same rate as it does in the non-Jewish community. And that's true of Christian communities as well. And within our nation, which just collectively normalized this behavior. To my LGBT friends, my Latino friends, my Muslim friends, my undocumented friends, my black friends, I will double down. I will double down on my work toward justice, and I will double down on my commitment toward the America we were trying to build, an America where we are all welcome, where our diversity is our strength, and where immigrants, like my refugee sister, have always been the lifeblood of America's greatness. American Jews exist in a place of unique privilege within the context of a Jewish history filled with persecution and within an American society that has embraced us. I promise that I will use what privileges I have while I have them to protect those more vulnerable than me. And to my friends with more privilege than me, I hope that you will stand in front of us until we are an unending mass of those who believe that our diversity is our strength and that out of greatness comes our goodness. To my conservative Jewish friends, who for years cried out that anti-Semitism would return to America, you are right and I am scared. Now, let me pause. You don't have to agree with that statement. You don't have to believe that anti-Semitism is coming back to America. What empathy requires of you is to understand how he sees it that way and what he might be feeling if that is true. I didn't believe we would ever see real white nationalism in the United States in my lifetime. I was wrong. I used to think that online anti-Semitism, whether it's targeting Jewish journalists, rabbis, or just people with Jewish-sounding names, was somehow something sort of funny. I was wrong. I used to think that America was different, was exceptional, that it would be the one place where Jews could totally be at home. But I'm starting to fear that my grandparents were right and that America is more like all of the other diasporas we have been in than I ever thought possible. Now, this is the part I really want you to hear him. To my friends who voted for him, I hope you will hear my fear and my pain and my feelings that you voted for a country where me, my Muslim, Latino, and LGBT friends, and my refugee sister are not welcome. I know many of you didn't support him for those reasons. But the fact that these things weren't disqualifying to you hurts like a cut to my heart. But more than anything else, to President-elect Trump, I hope that I'm wrong about the sort of president you will be and the sort of America that you will create. Now, I understand that some of you agreed with nothing he said. That's okay. That's part of what it means to be a big tent church. You don't have to believe that anti-Semitism is on the rise. You don't even have to believe that Donald Trump means some of the things that he actually said. You can believe that was all campaign bluffing, and I know some of you do believe that, that it was all just part of getting elected and he said whatever he had to say and he doesn't actually believe those things. He didn't actually do those things he's accused of. You can, that's fine. But what love means is that when my Jewish rabbi friend says that he feels scared and he feels like he's in it's a bad place for him, that I stand alongside him and say, I hear you. I feel you. I don't have an email like this, but the same would be true to somebody living in middle America and saying, I feel unincluded and not a part and jobs are leaving my community and I'm scared. I feel you. I hear you. Doesn't mean I agree. But love means that we listen. This is from a friend of mine, and I want to, it's on the screen. I don't have a thing. It's up here. Jimena was a friend of mine years ago. She's Mexican-American, and she's from Peoria, and she's going to say something about Peoria, and I want you to hear this specifically about Peoria in just a minute. She wrote this. It's 5:56 a.m. a Wednesday morning. I believe Jennifer read this to me before my eyes were fully open. She's like, you got to hear what Jimena said. Jimena writes, friends and family who voted for Trump know that my friends and family that voted against him, especially those who are minorities in this country, need to hear that they are loved, respected, valued by you. Because they have a real fear right now, not as much of Trump, but of you. You are most likely feared as a racist, sexist, bigoted, and your words and actions now are crucial in communicating otherwise. She's not saying, by the way, if you voted for him, that you are those things. She said, what I have inside is a fear. I have a feeling. I have a fear of this. What are you doing locally in your communities then to show love? By the way, it doesn't matter who won the election. That's a great question, right? No matter who we voted for, what we think, empathy means that that's a great question to ask no matter who won the election, no matter what. And if you claim to follow Christ, you should understand that we are made in God's image. That'd be a great church name. And that in itself gives us worth. In the midst of a confusing time, reach out and reassure them of this. Jennifer Dean and Molly Potter like this comment. I just noticed that this morning. I was like, call out Jennifer and Miley. I liked it too. Again, empathy says, my friend Jimena, who's Mexican, I hear what she feels. She got more specific in the comments. There was 21 comments by 6 a.m., and that number just went skyrocketing. And she responded later in the day. And I want you to read her response because she gets really specific about Peoria. We can skip the first paragraph. She's just saying people have been gracious and it's good. This has been a good conversation mostly. Peoria people, since I know that's a highly red area, she lives in Florida now, I think. Call up my family members who still live here and anyone you know who doesn't fit into the mold of white America. Ask my brother about his nearly weekly experience being called a spick and illegal working in the food industry in our town. Let's just be clear. I know this family. I went to Dominican Republic with her dad, and he was my roommate for 7 days, and he's a godly man, and I love him. And the thought that his kids in our town are called spicks and illegals. Ask my other brother about how his school friends would make jokes about being Mexican, thinking it was okay because they're friends. asked my dad about being fired many years ago because he didn't fit the mold of what a Mexican looks like in those parts. I'm going to jump down. Asked my mom about the woman at church who had known her for years, but asked her if she was illegal once she and dad spoke up for the stranger. This is our reality. Please reach out, grab coffee, listen, and commit to love and justice. Not on a mission trip serving brown people across the world, but in your very neighborhood. I'm sorry, folks, but love requires us to move towards the people that are being called names because of the color of their skin. Really? And so our hearts, I have two pictures here, but it should make our hearts burn no matter what you voted for when you see things like this in America again. It should make us, it should upset us. It should, part of what it means to love then, I just want that off the screen. Part of what it is to love is to move close. And if my brother and my sister here is saying, boy, I feel in America like it's not safe to be Mexican-American, then part of what it means for me to follow Jesus is to stand alongside of her and to say, I hear how you feel. Wednesday morning, one of the first things I did is I emailed Imam Mufti of the Islamic Foundation because I know him and I know his fears. And I just sent him an email that said, hey, I want you to know that I love you and I'm still with you. And I know that your community feels more afraid today and I'm gonna stand with you. And he and I don't agree. He's much more pessimistic and I'm often reminding him like, come on, there's laws, there's policies. America's free, you're gonna be okay. We're not gonna let those things happen to you. We're just not. We're gonna stand with you. And I'm much more optimistic because it's easier for me to be optimistic and that's fine. But I also am moving close enough to him that I'm willing to allow myself to feel what he feels and understand why he feels the way I do and not tell him that he's wrong for feeling the way he does, but rather standing in solidarity with him and saying, I'll just keep standing here. I wanna be quiet for just a minute and ask ourselves in this space, who do I need to move close to? I think Jimena's question's really good for us. No matter whom we voted for, some of us on the liberal side can talk about people in big generalities and not get to actual specific people that I'm moving into community with. And so for all of us, all over the political spectrum, who are you moving close to? Who in our culture feels marginalized and distanced and who is that? And how do I move next to them and feel what they feel and see what they see as an expression of my loving as Jesus loved? Let's just be quiet with that for just a minute. Sermonette number three. This is probably hardest for me as the pastor of a church. It's hard when you feel alienated from your tribe. And the headline, somebody prayed this morning. The church got a black eye this week. the headline on CNN the next morning, evangelicals hand Trump the election. It's a really hard one for me. I said the churches I grew up in were way over in that red part. When I think about this spectrum in America, I think, can we all recognize that there's this, right? On both sides. Can we own it? People throwing stuff at cops. Did I hear that they pulled somebody out of a car in one of the protests and beat them? Can we all condemn that behavior and stop justifying our own on our own crazy side? I feel like I get in these awful conversations where people are criticizing the crazies on one side, but they don't want to talk about the crazies in their own. Can we all acknowledge that there's, should have had a better word, I know, a nicer word, but there's people that are way out of bounds on both extremes. Way, way out of bounds. And then there's another group in here that I called partisans. They're definitely in one camp or the other, and they're in there for good reasons, and they're good people, and they don't descend to what we see happening in the campaign and now what we see happening afterwards, that they're good people. They just disagree. And then there's, I don't know what you call the rest of us, undecideds, independents. I like to think of us as above the fray, which feels a little bit pejorative, a little bit. What's hard for me is I recognize at this stage of my life that I live in this middle space. I just do. Where I said it last week, I feel like to love like Jesus loved, to be committed to truth, means that you're always selling a little bit of your soul to be partisan. You have to stay in this binary, you have to give up something to be a partisan. That's essential to what I think it means to follow Jesus. I think that. And I can get into political philosophy later. It's not the time or space. But I'm always listening. I'm always every election, I'm the undecided voter. I'm the person that's actually listening at the debates and trying to listen to policy and decide which policy seems to serve our country better. And I vote my conscience. And so some years I've voted third party out of my conscience. Some years I haven't voted out of conscience. Some years I've voted left, and some years I've voted right. I just vote out of my conscience, whatever I think is best for the country in this moment right now. And there is a feeling I have that the evangelical church, and this is painting with really broad brushes, right? Really broad brush strokes, is at least partisan. And what I feel like what I see in my Facebook feed is actually partisan and the group most likely to believe crazy conspiracy theories about everything. So partisan way over by the S, the second S. I'm going to say something about this post in just a second, but I want you to see one of the first things I saw on Wednesday morning. It's offensive to me as a Cubs fan, first of all. Can we say that? Don't take our song and change it. It's too soon. A godly group won today. How'd you decide that? I mean, the things that the candidate said are hardly godly. Hardly. And I get it. I get why some people voted for him. And most people I know, even that voted for him, did it with their nose, like, no, he's a, like, the things he said are deplorable, but I can't vote for her, and I feel like I have to vote for one of them, but to go so far as to say godly seems like I am more estranged from my evangelical roots than I've ever been in my life. I feel really, really far away from my evangelical roots. Now, I want to say about the person that posted this. She got called out for this. People responded pretty intensely. And by later in the day, she's a wonderful woman who issued an apology on Facebook, a very heartfelt, sincere apology. And she gave her reasons for why she said it the way she did, and I disagreed with her, still. So if you happen to have this person in your newsfeed, don't think I'm attacking the person. I took everything out just because I didn't want to attack the person. It's just a symbol of a whole lot of things that I saw in my Facebook threads. That feels like we're giving away our Christian voice in America for a Republican voice in America. And that makes me sad. And I don't even have a solution to this one. I just needed to say it as a pastor. The conversation I had with the two other pastors this week, one of the things we got to in the end was that it breaks my heart that so many people are leaving the evangelical church in America because they see, they feel, whether you agree or not, that the evangelical church is homophobic and bigoted and whatever, all the other things. And so they're leaving. And one of the things we were talking about in my office this week, there's this fire burning in my belly, is how do we say, no, you can take the Bible seriously and you can love Jesus, all the things that are the best things about evangelical, and you can come here and you don't have to you don't have to buy the Republican line to do that. You are welcome at Imago Dei Church. And I don't know how to say that loud enough in our city. Maybe if we did, we'd be flooded in a week, you know? Like, but I just passionate about who we are as a church and proclaiming to the world that you can follow Jesus. You can follow Jesus and you can love Jesus and you can take your Bible seriously and you can love gay people and you can love immigrants and you can love people that don't look like you. That's possible because some people don't feel like those things go together anymore. So that was sermon number 4. I didn't have a conclusion to that sermon, by the way. That was the poorest of the 5 sermons, I think. It didn't really have a conclusion. It had more of just the pastor's angst and a desire that we can be a place that what I'm trying to say is I don't want to throw away the word evangelical yet. It means good news. And I think what we have to offer the world is good news. So I don't want to throw the word away. But I'm so close to throwing the word away. That just makes me sad. It makes me sad because I think following Jesus is beautiful. And I think following Jesus makes me a better person. I think it would make our world a better place. And that somehow in our culture, the PR is that following Jesus makes you a worse person. People don't want you to be their neighbor if you're an evangelical Christian, and that shouldn't be like that. Sorry. I didn't think I'd cry today. Goodness. Sermon number 4. There's this great passage in Micah where God is condemning Israel. And so the first voice is theirs. And they say, with what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of olive oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? I mean, they're offering everything to God, right? Whatever you want of me, I'll do that. And God responds, he has shown you, O mortal, what is good and what the Lord requires of you, to act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. Jennifer and I have been talking a lot about this verse in our home just before this week. But just like this is we want this to be the mantra of our family. To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. I thought at this moment we would have a bigger conversation about what those 3 things mean. We don't have time. I want to get to some other things, but to me that's a framework for then how do I act in the world? We're going to talk about action in just a minute. Is that the framework for how, as Americans, if you all need to protest, protest. But do it in a way that's just and merciful and humble. Speak your mind. Write a blog post. That's great. Say what you think on Facebook. Great. But do it in that kind of way. That loves justice and acts. I always get the verbs messed up. Acts justly and loves mercy and walks humbly. Sermon number 5. Where do we go from here? I just want to say perspective is something that I wanted to make sure we got to at some point this morning, okay? I hear what you're feeling. I really, really do. I feel what you're feeling. Really, really do. And yet, then part of the thing is to say to my kids that there really aren't monsters under the bed. And so what I want to say is a little bit of perspective. Sometimes in our lives, this is from a blog, and he talks about like step 1 of human consciousness, and then he's going to talk about step 2. Step 2 is a bigger picture. So step 1 is that everything is amazing forever. So whatever I feel right now is where everything's going forever and ever and ever. Progress is a straight line. The truth is that's not what progress looks like. Progress looks like that. And you just happen to be right there. In the same vein, things are going bad and we think that everything's always going to be bad forever. The end of the Democratic Party. The end of democracy. Oh, please. You're just on that thing. It'll come back. Now, it doesn't mean that you don't feel what you feel, and it doesn't mean you just slip into lethargy. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying perspective. This is a chart of U.S. presidencies over the last probably 100 years, whatever. This is what we do, just so you know. As Americans, this is how we roll. One party gets in power. You want to know how to get in power? They suck. You win. And then you can govern for a while, and we'll all hate you. That's just how it goes. That's the political cycle. It just bounces back and forth and back and forth. And perspective is saying like, oh, well, maybe I feel like we went backwards. But we're just on that little thing. We'll get back to this thing again. And then we'll go back to that thing. And then this thing. And then that thing. And this thing. That's just what we do. On and on and on and on. Forever and ever. I love this perspective. On Tuesday night, we did a joint service with the churches I had mentioned earlier, election night service, and we, Pastor from United Presbyterian, and I, we co-taught a message, so we kind of had a conversation in front of people. And so this is from Psalm 146. He says, "Don't put your life in the hands of experts who know nothing of life, of salvation life. Mere humans don't have what it takes. When they die, their projects die with them. Instead, get help from the God of Jacob. Put your hope in God and know real blessing." I love that. When this leader dies, it dies with them. There's this great poem that he brought to my attention the other night that I think maybe it was in the recess, cobwebby parts of my mind, called Ozymandias. Anybody know Ozymandias? From Percy Shelley. "I met a traveler from an antique land who said, 'Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well these passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed.'" This is the best part. "And on the pedestal these words appear, 'My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, in despair. Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare. The lone and level sands stretch far away. I am Ozymandias. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Just sand." Now, part of what we'll come back to next week is in the celebration of Christ the King Sunday, is if Jesus is on the throne, perspective always zooms out. Love wins. Love wins. The kingdom of God is like yeast in the dough. It always keeps rising. And even though we're on this, maybe, it goes back to this. And if you feel like it's this, it goes back to this. That's what's always happening. We're always growing and becoming. And so perspective is this. Things that are still possible even now. Kindness, protest, babies, lovers, grace, crusty breads, beauty, faith, and belly laughing. Who knew that I was going to finish the sermon with, I'm going to give you the Bernie Sanders, Stephen Colbert punch. Who knew that's where this was going, huh? I didn't get into the Bernie Sanders thing a whole lot, but I want you to see the second paragraph, and I love this. So part of what we do moving forward is to keep perspective. The second is to put ourselves in action. I have talked to some of you this week who are like, you know what? I'm rededicating myself to political things in the United States. Somebody at our thing the other day said, like, I think the Electoral College is dumb. I'm working to change it. From my perspective, good luck. But that's going to fuel her. That's her energy. That's what she's going to do. To the degree that Mr. Trump is serious about pursuing policies that improve the lives of working families in this country, I and other progressives are prepared to work with him. Good for you, Bernie. Let's work together. Let's make life better for people. To the degree that he pursues racist, sexist, xenophobic, and anti-environment policies, we will vigorously oppose him. Good for you. Do something about it. Did anybody watch Saturday Night Live last night? The cold open was beautiful. It was a tribute to Leonard Cohen by, what's her name? Kate McKinnon. And then what did she say at the end? It was, what's that? I'm still here and I'm still fighting, or something along those lines. Yeah, it was awesome. I mean, and that line in that song always gets me. Love is not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. Oh, every time, that line. And I just want to, so then after the cold open, the skit, the first skit they did, and it was a group of progressives watching TV together, and it was like every half hour, their despair creeping in, and Chappelle and then Chris Rock were commenting about, like, they're like, this is the worst thing ever, and they're like, no, it isn't. This was totally unexpected. No, it's not. It was really funny. But then he said, you guys got to get to bed because you got to get up and mope tomorrow and write Facebook posts. I love that part. I think he said, you whiteys need to get to bed so you can get up tomorrow and mope and write Facebook posts. And that's great. There's a season to mourn. Yeah, your person didn't win. There's a season to mourn. There's a season to be sad. And there's a season, like Rabbi Daniel said, to double down, to get back to the work of creating the world that you want it to be. And I think it starts one person at a time. What Jimena said, it starts with finding people in our community that feel left out and lost and not a part of this, and embracing them and moving closer to them. Maybe that's in your neighborhood, maybe that's in your workplace. There's a lot of spaces where that can be. We talk every year at Easter, usually, about that N.T. Wright quote that's so lovely about everything counts. In God's economy, everything counts. Every act of kindness, every beautiful song, every time I pick up trash, every time I do good, every time my neighbor's garbage is falling over in the street and I pick it up and put it next to his garage, every meal that you cook, every smile, none of it's wasted in God's economy, that it all matters. So I know that you're sad. I know that it's been a hard week. I know that some of you are deeply disappointed and you feel like you've seen what somebody said is the underbelly of America and it's not pretty. But keep moving. Part of the church has always, there's always been this thing in the church where the church, most of its history has been the underdogs, or much of its history has been the underdogs. And actually, frankly, the church does well when it's most at the underdog. When we say, hey, we want a better world than what is. And we're going to work to make a world in which everybody's welcome. I want to end with Stephen Colbert because he makes me laugh a little bit. And great perspective. Parents, at the 7-minute mark, you might want to earmuff. There's one word, all right? And I'm sorry. I almost took it out and I just couldn't. And I let you know I cut off the last 3 minutes because it got a little more coarse and equally funny. But I cut some. So I want to finish with him, and I'll say a couple things, and then we'll be done. Almost on time.
I don't think I could sit down right now. We still don't know, right?
Nope.
And we don't have any idea when it's going to be called.
Nope.
Okay, is there any polls? I mean, is it literally going to come down like Alaska and Hawaii and stuff like that? Because we never wait for those people. We don't know. We love them, but, you know, they're too far out west. Now, I think we can agree that this has been an absolutely exhausting, bruising election for everyone.
That's right.
And it has come to an ending that I did not imagine. We all now feel the way Rudy Giuliani looks. seeing this election, seeing this election, you know, people all around the world, I mean, she's going off to Portugal. Everybody's going to be saying, has America lost its mind? And the answer is evidently, back off, buddy. We got 300 million guns and we're kind of stressed right now. By every metric, I mean, we are more divided than ever as a nation. Do we have this graphic from earlier before? According to the Pew Research Center, more than 4 in 10 voters say the other party's policies are so misguided they pose a threat to the nation. But you know what? Everybody feels that way. And not only that, more than half of Democrats say the Republican Party makes them afraid. While 49% of, do I have this right? Is it 49% of Republicans say the same thing about the Democratic Party? So both sides are terrified of the other side. And I think that's why the voting booth has a curtain, so you have someplace to hide after the election's over. So how did our politics get so poisonous? I think it's because we overdosed, especially this year. Mm-hmm. We drank too much of the poison. You take a little bit of it so you can hate the other side. and it tastes kind of good. And you like how it feels. And there's a gentle high to the condemnation, right? And you know you're right, right? You know you're right. When I was a kid, we didn't think about politics this much. A lot, but not this much. I grew up in Watergate. That was my first president, was Nixon.
Wow.
I'd come home from school. Couldn't watch the Beverly Hillbillies because there was Senator Sam Ervin with big eyebrows talking about crimes committed in the White House. That was a great dividing moment, I think, in American politics. That's the moment where we all stop trusting each other. Because Vietnam was wrapped up in that too. People were dying for political expediency rather than a cause they believed in. But as a kid, even with all that, we didn't talk about politics as much. We stuck with safe subjects. Like, you know, back then it was like, you know, you talk about religion at the dinner table or trying to guess which family member was gay, you know? back when it mattered, you know? Politics used to be something we thought about every 4 years, maybe 2 years if you didn't have a lot of social life, you know? You cared about the midterm elections. And that's good that we didn't think about it that much because it left room in our lives for other things and for other people. I'm from a big family. Jimmy, Eddie, Mary, Billy, Margot, Tommy, Jay, Peter, Paul, and Stephen. My mother was born 2 days before women could vote the first time in a presidential election. And again, we don't know what's going to happen, but I was thinking this was going to be the time that she got what she wanted. She told me at age 92, short before she died, oh, I think I would vote for Hillary this time. It's time. She only voted for one Democrat in her entire life. That was Kennedy. Because, spoiler alert, we're Catholic. Politics is a lot of horse race, and horse race is gambling. And gambling is, according to the Bible, a sin. Because it itself is a poison. Worrying about winning and not what the consequences of winning is. And I think the people who designed our democracy didn't want us in it all the time. Informed, yes. Politicking all the time? I don't think so. Not divided that way. They designed an election that was meant to confuse us and bore us a little bit. That's why the Electoral College exists and C-SPAN. And why the State of the Union begins with 20 minutes of shaking hands with grandpas. But now politics is everywhere, and that takes up precious brain space we could be using to remember all the things we actually have in common. So whether your side won or lost, we don't have to do this shit for a while. So keep your American flag up. But you can take off your American flag hat. You can put away your I voted stickers. And you can get back to your life. And I'd like to try to end this election season right now by voting unanimously on a few things that all bring us together. And I'm fair warning, some of these are silly. But in the face of something that might strike you as horrible, I think laughter is the best medicine. You cannot laugh and be afraid at the same time, and the devil cannot stand mockery. So here's some things Americans don't fight about. Here's one thing Americans can all agree on. When you agree on something, do you shout yes?
Yes!
Of course you do. Here's another. No matter where you stand on Hillary's private server, every American agrees, work email sucks. Also, no matter what your age, race, or political party, every American would agree that Kit Kats should be eaten in segments, not bitten into like a normal candy bar, you animal. And every red-blooded American knows that if you're ordering a bunch of pizzas, there's no reason to get a veggie one. No one's going to eat it. For Christ's sake, plain cheese is veggie. And all of us, I believe that all of us, from Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon, know that there are too many Portlands. They need to be numbered. Oregon, you're Portland number 2 now. And if you make a living pranking people on YouTube, all Americans ask that you walk slowly into the ocean, then put that on.
I encourage you to go watch the rest of that. It's also funny. I think what he said just hit me this week so good. Like, it's time to put away our politicking. It's time to put away all the name calling and all of that. Oppose whoever you have to oppose. Oppose ideas. Oppose policies. Before people. Before love. Before standing up with those that feel marginalized. Before empathy. Before the gospel. And don't give up. Don't tire just because you feel like it's like this. It'll go like this again. But not if we just lay down and let it happen. Not if we just give up and say, I tried and it didn't work. Let's pray. God, we feel a lot of things this morning, and I'm sure in a room this size, some people disagreed with everything I said, and help us to be loving and gracious and kind and to lean into each other. Help us not to grow weary in doing good. And help us, God, no matter how we voted in our community, to reach out to those who feel marginalized and to embrace them and welcome them, to say, sit at my table. Come sit with me in our church where everybody fits, everybody belongs. In your name I pray, amen.